Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Edward Hauer. Hauer has published 8 novels and 2 collections of short stories. His novels include The New Life Hotel, A Garden of Demons, and The Storms of May. His most recent novel is entitled Slick, and it was published under the imprint of Cuga Lake Books in October 2012. His writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, and American Scholar. For the last 6 years, Hauer has been teaching at Auburn Prison's Cornell Prison Education Program. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ben.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Now, you've written many novels that take place in exotic places, but this new one takes place in upstate New York, so you've, in some ways, come home again.
I think it's the first time I've written about an area I actually lived in for such a long time. I lived in the Catskill Mountains when I was working at a forestry camp, which was supposed to help juvenile delinquents. And the book sort of came out of that. I went back to that area about 40 years later. It was rather sad to see how the farms had gone under. And in a way, I'm like the character in Slick. His name is Pete, but they call him Slick. And going back, trying to figure out what's happened since the last time I was there.
So is Pete, a.k.a. Slick, somewhat of a composite of yours? Because this character seems kind of haunted, like he's looking for what happened in the past to make sense of his life.
He's a bit of an outsider, and artists and writers are outsiders. He's an outsider also because he's been incarcerated, and he has that vision of society from the bottom, which is, it gives people sort of insights that the rest of us don't have.
Yeah.
And I think I got that insight myself from being around a lot of violent people, teaching in prisons and working with kids who'd been in trouble with the law. And it interested me, the correlation between that vision and the vision of a writer has its interesting points.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I couldn't tell if this character, Slick, was hallucinating or just, you know, attaching himself to memories from the past. Were you deliberately trying to keep that obscure?
Well, the part that's obscure is when he talks to the angels in the cemetery. I don't want to let people know whether that's really true, they're answering him back, or it's a fantasy. His memories are real memories, I think. And he remembers the family that was very good to him when he was 15. The old man who worked the late shift at the camp, and his daughter and his daughter's friend. And he has crystal clear memories of this. And he wants to go back and find everything warm and welcoming. But of course, nothing is the same as it used to be.
Yeah,
he has
yeah.
many mysteries he has to kind of solve before he can even begin to get back.
Yeah, and crystal clear memories sometimes are what people wished had happened, you know?
Of course.
So I couldn't tell exactly if he was fantasizing about this past that seemed so pastoral compared to, you know, what he had lived in the ensuing years.
That's a good point, because memory is really a mixture of recalling and imagination. And I think the longer it goes, the more imagination sort of jumps in.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely sure that something happened. But of course, any lawyer will tell you that eyewitness accounts are not particularly reliable.
Oh, they aren't. I mean, just the passing moment, the two of us can see something differently. I've seen it in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book reminded me a little bit, and I hope you don't take this as an insult because it's not meant to be. It's sort of Stephen King-ish. Because it was kind of mysterious and dark, and there was fantasy in it, the talking angels, which I sort of believed were answering him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was constructed in that way that it made it mysterious and well-crafted, and we could still identify.
Well, thank you. I've actually never read Stephen King, but if you say so, that's not a bad thing. You know, I know, I've met him once. He's a nice guy.
And, uh-huh.
Yeah, it's dark. It was... part of it is me trying to reevaluate what I did those years ago, trying to help people, but sometimes not. Probably being a part of a system which was quite corrupt.
Mm.
And another institution I worked in, which is local, which I won't name, terrible things happened there after I left. There were rapes. They were, and I had to question myself. Maybe my intentions were good, but being part of that system, I may have been tainted by the problems that happened.
Yeah, and you know what I want to ask you too, Edward? A lot of women talk about this, but men don't talk about what it feels like to age and to get older. And it seems to me this book is maybe you following that map of looking back as a writer and as a man.
Sure. I think that's true. You look back on the traumas that some of these kids had, and I still have a guilty feeling about a boy in this camp who actually was raped and what it did to him. And the character in the book is tormented by this as well.
Yeah.
What did I do about it? Not much. Nobody would fess up. And then one of the counselors happened. He did it too. But it was after I'd left. So.
Well, that seems to be something that's permeating our culture. I mean, look what's happening with all these sports figures and what's happening with coaches and... You know, no, but people are still afraid to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It doesn't have to do with the past when we didn't know better.
Yeah.
Human beings are still afraid of losing something. Yeah.
So Slick, the boy, the girls call him Slick. The one wonderful thing in his life was the warmth that he got from his family.
Yeah.
Sort of offset the brutality of the system that he was in.
Yeah.
And remained in after he left. He's got a criminal record and...
But was this a book that was percolating in you for a long time?
Mm-hmm.
That you wanted to come back and write something about the place that you've lived most of your life?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, I lived there about 4 years.
Yeah, but I'm talking about upstate New York in general.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so is it something that you worked on through the years, or did it just come out in a big spurt?
You know, I saved all the reports I wrote on these kids from 1967, 68. You had to write a report every 3 months.
Oh.
Which I sort of loved doing because I was a writer. But my God, I still got the reports of these kids who seem, I'm sure some of them are quite aged now. But
Have you tried to get in touch with any of them and present the novel to them? Say that I've written about your life now?
No, I couldn't possibly. But nice thing did happen years ago when my first wife and I ran a group home for girls in Yonkers. I got a telephone call about 15 years later, and one of the girls, who is now a grown-up woman and a mother, just wanted to thank us for giving them a home, a kind of sanctuary where they could live, and that felt really good.
Yeah. Well, this novel is it's a deep psychological novel. It's a great, well-rounded portrait of this guy. I think it's a wonderful tribute, if you will, to the past that you, I guess, still feel guilty about.
Well... Yeah, the guilt is sort of gone away, but sure, thank you. I'm glad you...
Yeah. I also want to... I mentioned that you've traveled, and a lot of your novels have been in foreign lands. Do you write while you're traveling? I know you still travel. Are you constantly writing while you travel? And is the atmosphere of the travel permeating your head?
I always have it in my head that what I'm writing while I travel, which is always a journal... is going to be of some use later. When I lived in Africa, I wrote these letters to my fiance. I wrote maybe 6-7 letters a week, 10-page, single-spaced letters. I just had to record everything. Later on, she confessed that she actually didn't read them all. But my God, I had that material.
Yeah.
And I wrote a great deal of journals when I lived in Sri Lanka. I didn't live there. I've spent about 6 months there. And I never knew what I was going to do about it. And then I was incapacitated with my back, and I couldn't move, really. And I got those journals out, and bingo, out came a novel.
Yeah.
That was the only thing I could do, was just lie there and write, and it was wonderful.
Much of your writing is about memory, then, isn't it? It's calling up the past.
I've used my journals a lot, yeah.
You have mentioned in your writer's statement on your website that you were very influenced by Tennessee Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still? Is he still part of your life and consciousness?
I love his work. He deals with people on the verge of society, the vulnerable people, the damaged people, And I'm drawn to those people myself. And he has the ability to find that part of everyone who is vulnerable, who needs to express some pain, but can't do it except under very special circumstances, mm-hmm. which, of course, is the work of art. Then they are healed, at least for the time being. At least they've asserted their humanity. To me, this is in a very exciting moment when people are able to do this. Mm-hmm. So that's what Tennessee Williams did, and I hope that, you know, my work kind of shines a light on people at their vulnerable but also bravest moments.
Yeah. Tennessee Williams also was able to manufacture, you know, somehow call up poetry in the most painful situations. Some of his lines were so amazingly touching.
Yeah.
And it would come out of people that were so damaged.
I know. But it's all accessible language. He did write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as good as his plays, but it's very moving, some of them.
Have you ever thought about writing plays to bring some of these people?
I wrote one play years ago. It was produced at Cornell, and then it went to Cortland. And that's the extent of my... I loved writing dialogue. I should write plays, because that dialogue is what I do best. It just comes out. I could write dialogue forever.
Yeah, the dialogue in your novels has been really quite convincing and wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, that's the easiest thing it is for me to write. And I ought to write a play sometime.
now, you've published many of your novels with mainstream publishers. So mm-hmm. so this current novel, Slick, has been published by your own imprint mm-hmm. that you created, Cuga Lake Books.
It came out of a much longer book, which, in fact, I couldn't find a publisher for. And I could sort of see why. It wasn't all that good, unfortunately.
So Slick is a piece from a longer novel?
Yeah.
Ah.
So by the time I got it down to the size it ought to be, I'd already sort of used up the publishers who's already seen my book. And it's also a little bit short for most mainstream publishers.
Yeah, it's 158 pages or something like that.
158 pages in that very small format, but it's a novella, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the most difficult thing to publish in the world.
Really?
So I said, the hell with it, I'm going to just publish it myself, get a bunch of other people involved. Peter Fortunato and Jack Hopper published their poetry books at the same time, and we gave a reading together. And so it's a way of bringing a local imprint to Ithaca. It's not really a publishing house, it's an imprint.
In other words, so you will be looking at manuscripts, but you won't be doing editing, and people have to pay for the printing, right?
Yeah. That's exactly true.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Edward Hauer. We're talking a bit about his new book, Slick. Let's talk a little bit more about self-publishing. Self-publishing used to be thought of as the final step of defeat in some ways because people couldn't get published. That has all changed because of the internet, I would say, and people writing blogs, and writing is everywhere.
Yeah, the scene has changed a lot. If you look at who the big prize winners are in the last several years, often they come from extremely obscure presses, which may publish two or three books a year.
Mm-hmm.
The really good stuff isn't being picked up by the mainstream publishers as much as it should be.
Yeah.
They've mm-hmm. been brought up by enormous European corporations, and they have to show big profits.
Yeah, that's
the
bottom line.
So people are turning to the internet, to independent presses. They're self-publishing, and then sometimes the self-published books are picked up later by other presses. So everything's in a state of flux.
Yeah, it feels like small presses are flourishing, though. I see so much happening with small presses, at least on the internet.
They come up, they come up, they disappear, a new one comes up. Everything's changing.
Yeah, and then we got to remember that Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and those guys started their own press in San Francisco.
Exactly.
And then look how their careers flourished in that era, even.
Stephen Crane cranked out copies of his book, Maggie Girl of the Streets, and sold it on street corners, 50 cents in San Francisco.
Oh, I love that.
And, of course, Proust's first volume was self-published, and so forth and so on.
Yeah, yeah. The great black poet Pat Parker used to mm-hmm. publish her own stuff, little tiny pamphlets, and sell them in San Francisco. I remember that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the fact that you've been teaching for 6 years at Auburn prison under the guise of the Cornell Prison Education Program. Mm-hmm. What are you teaching? Is it writing?
I've been teaching writing classes. The last 2 years, actually, I was at Cayuga, a correctional facility, which is near Auburn. I've mostly taught essay courses and fiction courses. Last year, I taught African literature, which is something I used to teach at Cornell. The creative writing courses, the students use their own life experiences, but I try to get them to write about things in their lives which were kind of satisfying to them, which made them feel better, which made them not feel like outcasts.
Yeah, so they can come to terms with some of the stuff in their life.
If they write all about their crimes, it gets to be cops and robbers. It's not so good. And a lot of them don't want to write about that. It's just depressing for them. But they love to be able to connect with the rest of the world because their stories of growing up and falling in love and having hassles with their parents and trying to find a job and not so dissimilar from other people's. And they get to explore parts of their personalities that don't get looked at much in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Prison's a very closed down place. You have to be emotionally very closed down to survive there.
How bad.
And you have to defend yourself. Vulnerability is an invitation to violence.
Mm-hmm.
But in the classroom, those rules are gone. You can actually talk about very scary and personal things. And I've actually seen at the end of one of my classes, the guys were hugging each other, which is something they would never do anywhere else.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because they were so moved by the fact that they had revealed things about themselves. It's interesting. The first class, I put the desks and chairs up pretty close together. They immediately moved them as far away from each other as they could.
I can see
They said, we're in prison. We want some space around us. We don't trust these guys. We never met the guys in our class before. We don't trust them. The end class, they were all clustered close together. They had moved their desks and chairs right up into a sort of a cluster at the front of the class.
Yeah, well, writing is intimate, and they're probably intimacy to them was never anything that was safe.
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, so what happens with this writing? Do you critique it? Do you discuss it? Does it leave the prison? Have you published any of it?
I don't publish this, but I run it pretty much like I do classes at Ithaca College at Cornell. Or other workshops I've given around the country, and I tell them that this, your standards are you have to meet university standards, and they do. There are a lot of prison anthologies. I don't need to add to them, but some of the students have individually published around in various places. John Crutchfield, who is now out, has published some very good places.
Wow.
So there's some talent there.
Mm-hmm. How does that affect you as a writer? Are you affected by bringing the writer out and in some of these people that most people have probably given up on?
I am. It moves me a lot how they use writing as therapy, but then they take it one step further in which they turn their own experiences into art. And they can see that way that their experiences have worth. Just to sort of spew it out onto the page doesn't do it. But if they then use it to shape it, either as an essay or a short story, then they can sort of distance themselves from it and see that their life has parts to it that are worthwhile, that are valuable. The joy that they get out of this experience is absolutely a big high for the teacher. That's why people like to teach in prisons, and some of the most unlikely retired professors are teaching there and being totally energized by it.
Yeah, and Tracy Ziegler, the artist, has been bringing her artwork into the prison, and I had her on the show, and she was talking about how this is the first time some of these people have seen art, and they look at the paintings and they go, that's where I want to be sitting. It's on a porch looking, it's this vision of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what art and writing, I'm sure, can do.
And it's redemption. I had a student who from the South, and it's a picture of the Mississippi River. They had him writing about photographs. And he made up this story, just in this photograph, a man sitting by the river, of a person who goes into a flooded area and rescues a mother and child and brings them to safety.
Wow.
And it was vivid. I said, you ever been through a flood like that? He says, no. But it was obviously redemption for himself. He was helping somebody else, bringing them back out of this dangerous and dark situation into the safety again.
Yeah.
And that's what writing is.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Now, you also teach workshops in foreign countries like Greece, Florida.
Yeah.
What are you teaching? Are you teaching in the language
of
the country?
I'm teaching in English. Greece is a kind of British, I have to say, it's a kind of a New Age resort in which you can take Reiki, or you can take shamanism, or you can take, windsurfing, or you can take writing. And it's a beautiful place, and the students are good. They often come from the information industries, the BBC, a lot of them, and so I teach writing in India, where I was part of my job. I was there on Fulbright twice, mm-hmm. and so I would travel around and give workshops. I gave a workshop for the teachers, the professors at the University of Kathmandu in Nepal, and I had introduced creative writing in India to where I was teaching, and I gave them my syllabus, and a year later I got a letter from them. They had put that in their syllabus, so that was very gratifying to me.
What's the difference between teaching in foreign countries and teaching here?
They're not so used to participating in countries where, you know, have been part of the British Empire. They're used to being lectured to. And the professor's job is to talk. The student's job is to write down as much as they can in order to regurgitate it at the exams. Well, a creative writing course needs people to participate, to talk up, to read aloud from things they've read. And the professors at first in my class were very shy about doing this, but suddenly they loved it. You know, I got them all writing about a childhood object they loved, and they got teddy bears. I've never given a class when somebody has come up with a teddy bear. And so these rather elderly professors from India and Nepal would talk about their teddy bears when they were kids, and it meant so much to them. It's always a kind of link between them and their families. Somebody gave them a bear, and or whatever it was.
Wow, that is so great.
So their memories of their childhoods and their families come back with this exercise.
Oh, I love it. It works everywhere.
It works.
It's a universal memory or gift from childhood.
Always use that exercise.
Yeah. Wow.
My wife, Alison Lurie, and I have sort of worked in many places as a team in Britain and in Greece and in Sri Lanka and in India.
I want to ask you this. So, looking back on your career, you've been very successful. You've published a lot of novels with mainstream publishers and gotten a lot of reviews in big places. Was your vision of being a writer, is it the same as what the reality turned out to be? Are you happy with your career?
Well, I don't think I'm as rich and famous as I'd like to be.
Did you think being rich and famous really is
doesn't
the
really
ultimate
matter.
Goal?
That's the part of me that's really unworthy of the rest of me. But sure, I'm happy. I thought of the writing as a kind of a big adventure. And I also wanted to have adventures, which is why I lived in Africa and India and worked with people who are unlike me, as much unlike me as possible. I really haven't cared that I made money or got famous. I'm not all that successful in terms of, most.
But you have made a living at it, and you've kept at it. You haven't just done it for a couple of years when you were young or something.
Very, very, very fortunate to be able to do that. And the living has come from teaching at Ithaca College and Cornell and other places, Duke and North Carolina. And, I never made much money out of my books. I never will. I'm not that sort of writer. I'm not a commercial writer.
Yeah. How has the world of writing changed through the years that you've been practicing this art?
I've noticed that everybody now who's a writer has got an MFA.
I've noticed that too.
If you want to be if you want to go into business, you got an MBA. If you want to be an electrician, you go to electrician school. If you want to be a writer, you go to writer school. Didn't used to be that.
There's also a lot of debate about that, about the people who get MFAs are getting kind of ruined by the fact that they're part of the system.
Well, it gives writers a place to go and hide out for 3 years and find out what they can do, and that's good. But then they get out, there's no jobs out there. A lot of them end up teaching freshman comp.
Yeah, I know. I asked somebody, what do you do with an MFA? Well, you either have to write or teach. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many choices.
But it gives you a chance to Teaching is a good job for a writer.
Yeah.
You have better hours.
Yeah.
It doesn't drain you. I've had jobs which completely drained me.
Oh, I'm sure. Which I want to bring up. It says in your biography that you were a nightclub singer, or you used to be a singer. I want to hear about that.
Well, just for 3 years when I lived in East Africa. If you had an instrument, you could carry a tune, you could probably get hired. And I had the only 12-string guitar in the Republic of Kenya. I just sort of pushed myself forward, and they were happy to have somebody to be on their show. The Russians had just given the Kenyan government a television station, and they wanted to use it. And these enormous cameras with these red light, like cyclops eyes, and they'd wheel these things around the studio. And when they were setting up, they'd focus on a fishbowl. And they, so the viewers at home, all 900 of them in the country, could watch the fish going back and forth. And sometimes you'd be watching the fish for 45 minutes because it would take them a while to figure out how to set up the stage. And so
oh, my God.
And then I would come on and sing country western songs, which in those days were popular in Africa. And I sang in some nightclubs. I had a good time, but I wasn't all that good. When I came back, I had sung in coffee houses in Greenwich Village in the old folky days. But when I came back, I just wasn't as good as the people who were serious about it.
Oh, yeah, Baez and Dylan and stuff. Wasn't that the era when you probably came back?
Yeah. Huh. And I realized that I have to, if I wanted to be a writer, I had to write and put everything into that.
Yeah, so you never tried to write songs?
I did write a few songs. Yeah.
Ah.
Best forgotten.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Can you talk to us about anything that you're working on now that we might expect in the future? And are you going to be giving any more readings?
I'm working on a novel now. I am going back in my memory. This is something that seems to have been around a long time. Back to Africa again, when I was in my 20s. When you get to be in your 70s, you start remembering things very vividly.
Mm-hmm.
And let me get it written down as fast as possible. That's fun. I haven't got any readings scheduled, although I'm always willing to read. I'm probably be giving another writer's workshop at the prison in the fall.
Uh-huh. And the book about Africa, we can expect it maybe next year?
No, it's going to take more time. But I have a book of essays, which I think I may. I've been publishing books about essays in journals about India, about my life when I was in the opera. I was a non-singing person in the opera with Beverly Sills.
Wow.
Some of my sort of offbeat experiences, and I'm going to collect them together and publish them either with Cayuga Lake Books or somewhere else. I don't know.
Well, that's great.
Another project.
We look forward to whatever you come out with.
Well,
contact information, people can get in touch with you?
Sure. I have an email, edwardhower@gmail.com. For some reason, I'm not in the telephone book.
What about the website?
Yes, edwardhower.com,
yeah.
My website.
Yeah, it's a nice website, too. Edward Howard, thank you so much for joining us again. Edward Howard's latest book is called Slick.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.